On Writing, a memoir of the craft. Honesty's the best policy. Miguel de Cervantes. Liars prosper. Anonymous. First foreword. In the early 90s, it might have been 1992, but it's hard to remember when you're having a good time. I joined a rock and roll band composed mostly of writers. The Rock Bottom Remainders were the brainchild of Kathy Kamen Goldmark, a book publicist and musician from San Francisco. The group included Dave Barry on lead guitar, Ridley Pearson on bass, Barbara Kingsolver on keyboards, Robert Fulgham on mandolin, and me on rhythm guitar. There was also a trio of chick singers, a la the Dixie Cups, made up, usually, of Kathy, Tad Bartimus, and Amy Tan. The group was intended as a one-shot deal. We would play two shows at the American Booksellers Convention, get a few laughs, recapture our misspent youth for 3 or 4 hours, then go our separate ways. It didn't happen that way, because the group never quite broke up. We found that we liked playing together too much to quit, and with a couple of ringer musicians on sax and drums, plus, in the early days, our musical guru, Al Cooper, at the heart of the group, we sounded pretty good. You'd pay to hear us. Not a lot, not U2 or E Street Band prices, but maybe what the old-timers call roadhouse money. We took the group on tour, wrote a book about it. My wife took the photos and danced when the spirit took her, which was quite often, and continue to play now and then, sometimes as the Remainders, sometimes as Raymond Burr's Legs. The personnel comes and goes. Columnist Mitch Albom has replaced Barbara on keyboards, and Al doesn't play with the group anymore because he and Kathy don't get along. But the core has remained Kathy, Amy, Ridley, Dave, Mitch Albom, and me, plus Josh Kelly on drums and Erasmo Palo on sax. We do it for the music, but we also do it for the companionship. We like each other, and we like having a chance to talk sometimes about the real job, the day job people are always telling us not to quit. We are writers, and we never ask one another where we get our ideas. We know we don't know. One night while we were eating Chinese before a gig in Miami Beach, I asked Amy if there was any one question she was never asked during the Q&A that follows almost every writer's talk. That question you never get to answer when you're standing in front of a group of author-struck fans and pretending you don't put your pants on one leg at a time like everyone else. Amy paused, thinking it over very carefully, and then said, "No one ever asks about the language." I owe an immense debt of gratitude to her for saying that. I had been playing with the idea of writing a little book about writing for a year or more at that time, but it held back because I didn't trust my own motivations. Why did I want to write about writing? What made me think I had anything worth saying? The easy answer is that someone who has sold as many books of fiction as I have must have something worthwhile to say about writing it. But the easy answer isn't always the truth. Colonel Sanders sold a hell of a lot of fried chicken, but I'm not sure anyone wants to know how he made it. If I was going to be presumptuous enough to tell people how to write, I felt there had to be a better reason than my popular success. Put another way, I didn't want to write a book, even a short one like this, that would leave me feeling like either a literary gas bag or a transcendental asshole. There are enough of those books and those writers on the market already, thanks. But Amy was right. Nobody ever asks about the language. They ask the DeLillos and the Updikes and the Styrons, but they don't ask popular novelists. Yet many of us proles also care about the language in our humble way and care passionately about the art and craft of telling stories on paper. What follows is an attempt to put down, briefly and simply, how I came to the craft, what I know about it now, and how it's done. It's about the day job. It's about the language. This book is dedicated to Amy Tan, who told me in a very simple and direct way that it was okay to write it. Second Foreword. This is a short book because most books about writing are filled with bullshit. Fiction writers, present company included, don't understand very much about what they do, not why it works when it's good, not why it doesn't when it's bad. I figured the shorter the book, the less the bullshit. One notable exception to the bullshit rule is The Elements of Style by William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White. There is little or no detectable bullshit in that book. Of course, it's short. At 85 pages, it's much shorter than this one. I'll tell you right now that every aspiring writer should read The Elements of Style. Rule 17 in the chapter titled Principles of Composition is omit needless words. I will try to do that here. Third Foreword. One rule of the road not directly stated elsewhere in this book: the editor is always right. The corollary is that no writer will take all of his or her editor's advice, for all have sinned and fallen short of editorial perfection. Put another way, to write is human, to edit is divine. Chuck Verrill edited this book, as he has so many of my novels. As usual, Chuck, you were divine. C.V. I was stunned by Mary Carr's memoir, The Liars' Club, not just by its ferocity, its beauty, and by her delightful grasp of the vernacular, but by its totality. She is a woman who remembers everything about her early years. I'm not that way. I lived an odd, herky-jerky childhood, raised by a single parent who moved around a lot in my earliest years and who, I am not completely sure of this, may have farmed my brother and me out to one of her sisters for a while because she was economically or emotionally unable to cope with us for a time. Perhaps she was only chasing our father, who piled up all sorts of bills and then did a run-out when I was 2 and my brother David was 4. If so, she never succeeded in finding him. My mom, Nellie Ruth Pillsbury King, was one of America's early liberated women, but not by choice. Mary Carr presents her childhood in an almost unbroken panorama. Mine is a fogged-out landscape from which occasional memories appear like isolated trees, the kind that look as if they might like to grab and eat you. What follows are some of those memories, plus assorted snapshots from the somewhat more coherent days of my adolescence and young manhood. This is not an autobiography. It is, rather, a kind of curriculum vitae, my attempt to show how one writer was formed. Not how one writer was made. I don't believe writers can be made, either by circumstances or by self-will, although I did believe those things once. The equipment comes with the original package, yet it is by no means unusual equipment. I believe large numbers of people have at least some talent as writers and storytellers, and that those talents can be strengthened and sharpened. If I didn't believe that, writing a book like this would be a waste of time. This is how it was for me, that's all, a disjointed growth process in which ambition, desire, luck, and a little talent all played a part. Don't bother trying to read between the lines, and don't look for a through line. There are no lines, only snapshots, most out of focus. My earliest memory is of imagining I was someone else, imagining that I was, in fact, the Ringling Brothers Circus Strong Boy. This was at my Aunt Ethlyn and Uncle Oren's house in Durham, Maine. My aunt remembers this quite clearly and says I was 2½ or maybe 3 years old. I had found a cement cinder block in a corner of the garage and had managed to pick it up. I carried it slowly across the garage's smooth cement floor. Except in my mind, I was dressed in an animal skin singlet, probably a leopard skin, and carrying the cinder block across the center ring. The vast crowd was silent. A brilliant blue-white spotlight marked my remarkable progress. Their wondering faces told the story. Never had they seen such an incredibly strong kid. And he's only two, someone muttered in disbelief. Unknown to me, wasps had constructed a small nest in the lower half of the cinder block. One of them, perhaps pissed off at being relocated, flew out and stung me on the ear. The pain was brilliant, like a poisonous inspiration. It was the worst pain I had ever suffered in my short life, but it only held the top spot for a few seconds. When I dropped the cinder block on one bare foot, mashing all five toes, I forgot all about the wasp. I can't remember if I was taken to the doctor, and neither can my Aunt Ethlyn. Uncle Orrin, to whom the evil cinder block surely belonged, is almost 20 years dead. But she remembers the sting, the mashed toes, and my reaction. "How you howled, Stephen," she said. "You were certainly in fine voice that day." A year or so later, my mother, my brother, and I were in West De Pere, Wisconsin. I don't know why. Another of my mother's sisters, Cal, a whack beauty queen during World War II, lived in Wisconsin with her convivial beer-drinking husband, and maybe Mom had moved to be near them. If so, I don't remember seeing much of the Weimers, any of them, actually. My mother was working, but I can't remember what her job was, either. I want to say it was a bakery she worked in, but I think that came later, when we moved to Connecticut to live near her sister Lois and her husband. No beer for Fred, and not much in the way of conviviality, either. He was a crew-cut daddy who was proud of driving his convertible with the top up. God knows why. There was a stream of babysitters during our Wisconsin period. I don't know if they left because David and I were a handful, or because they found better-paying jobs, or because my mother insisted on higher standards than they were willing to rise to. All I know is that there were a lot of them. The only one I remember with any clarity is Eula, or maybe she was Beulah. She was a teenager. She was as big as a house, and she laughed a lot. Eula Beulah had a wonderful sense of humor. Even at four, I could recognize that. But it was a dangerous sense of humor. There seemed to be a potential thunderclap hidden inside each hand-patting, butt-rocking, head-tossing outburst of glee. When I see those hidden camera sequences where real-life babysitters and nannies just all of a sudden wind up and clout the kids, it's my days with Eula Beulah I always think of. Was she as hard on my brother David as she was on me? I don't know. He's not in any of these pictures. Besides, he would have been at less risk from Hurricane Eula Beulah's dangerous winds. At six, he would have been in the first grade and off the gunnery range for most of the day. Eula Beulah would be on the phone, laughing with someone and beckon me over. She would hug me, tickle me, get me laughing, and then, still laughing, go upside my head hard enough to knock me down. Then she would tickle me with her bare feet until we were both laughing again. Eula Beulah was prone to farts, the kind that are both loud and smelly. Sometimes, when she was so afflicted, she would throw me on the couch, drop her wool-skirted butt on my face, and let loose. "Pow!" she'd cry in high glee. It was like being buried in marsh gas fireworks. I remember the dark, the sense that I was suffocating, and I remember laughing, because while what was happening was sort of horrible, it was also sort of funny. In many ways, Eula Beulah prepared me for literary criticism. After having a 200-pound babysitter fart on your face and yell, "Pow!", the village voice holds few terrors. I don't know what happened to the other sitters, but Eula Beulah was fired. It was because of the eggs. One morning, Eula Beulah fried me an egg for breakfast. I ate it and asked for another one. Eula Beulah fried me a second egg, then asked if I wanted another one. She had a look in her eye that said, "You don't dare eat another one, Stevie." So I asked for another one, and another one, and so on. I stopped after seven, I think. Seven is the number that sticks in my mind, and quite clearly. Maybe we ran out of eggs. Maybe I cried off. Or maybe Eula Beulah got scared. I don't know, but probably it was good that the game ended at seven. Seven eggs is quite a few for a four-year-old. I felt all right for a while, and then I yarked all over the floor. Eula Beulah laughed, then went upside my head, then shoved me into the closet and locked the door. Pow! If she'd locked me in the bathroom, she might have saved her job, but she didn't. As for me, I didn't really mind being in the closet. It was dark, but it smelled of my mother's Coty perfume, and there was a comforting line of light under the door. I crawled to the back of the closet, Mom's coats and dresses brushing along my back. I began to belch, long, loud belches that burned like fire. I don't remember being sick to my stomach, but I must have been, because when I opened my mouth to let out another burning belch, I yarked again instead, all over my mother's shoes. That was the end for Eula Beulah. When my mother came home from work that day, the babysitter was fast asleep on the couch, and little Stevie was locked in the closet, fast asleep, with half-digested fried eggs drying in his hair. Our stay in West De Pere was neither long nor successful. We were evicted from our third-floor apartment when a neighbor spotted my 6-year-old brother crawling around on the roof and called the police. I don't know where my mother was when this happened. I don't know where the babysitter of the week was either. I only know that I was in the bathroom, standing with my bare feet on the heater, watching to see if my brother would fall off the roof or make it back into the bathroom okay. He made it back. He is now 55 and living in New Hampshire. When I was 5 or 6, I asked my mother if she had ever seen anyone die. Yes, she said. She had seen one person die and had heard another one. I asked how you could hear a person die, and she told me that it was a girl who had drowned off Prout's Neck in the 1920s. She said the girl swam out past the rip, couldn't get back in, and began screaming for help. Several men tried to reach her, but that day's rip had developed a vicious undertow, and they were all forced back. In the end, they could only stand around, tourists and townies, the teenager who became my mother among them, waiting for a rescue boat that never came, and listening to that girl scream until her strength gave out and she went under. Her body washed up in New Hampshire, my mother said. I asked how old the girl was. Mom said she was 14, then read me a comic book and packed me off to bed. On some other day, she told me about the one she saw, a sailor who jumped off the roof of the Graymore Hotel in Portland, Maine, and landed in the street. "He splatted," my mother said in her most matter-of-fact tone. She paused, then added, "The stuff that came out of him was green. I have never forgotten it." That makes two of us, Mom. Most of the 9 months I should have spent in the first grade, I spent in bed. My problem started with the measles, a perfectly ordinary case, and then got steadily worse. I had bout after bout of what I mistakenly thought was called striped throat. I lay in bed drinking cold water and imagining my throat in alternating stripes of red and white. This was probably not so far wrong. At some point, my ears became involved, and one day my mother called a taxi, she did not drive, and took me to a doctor too important to make house calls, an ear specialist. For some reason, I got the idea that this sort of doctor was called an otiologist. I didn't care whether he specialized in ears or assholes. I had a fever of 104 degrees, and each time I swallowed, pain lit up the sides of my face like a jukebox. The doctor looked in my ears, spending most of his time, I think, on the left one. Then he laid me down on his examining table. "Lift up a minute, Stevie," his nurse said, and put a large absorbent cloth, it might have been a diaper, under my head, so that my cheek rested on it when I lay back down. I should have guessed that something was rotten in Denmark. Who knows, maybe I did. There was a sharp smell of alcohol. A clank as the ear doctor opened his sterilizer. I saw the needle in his hand. It looked as long as the ruler in my school pencil box, and tensed. The ear doctor smiled reassuringly and spoke the lie for which doctors should be immediately jailed, time of incarceration to be doubled when the lie is told to a child. "Relax, Stevie. This won't hurt." I believed him. He slid the needle into my ear and punctured my eardrum with it. The pain was beyond anything I have ever felt since. The only thing close was the first month of recovery after being struck by a van in the summer of 1999. That pain was longer in duration, but not so intense. The puncturing of my eardrum was pain beyond the world. I screamed. There was a sound inside my head, a loud kissing sound. Hot fluid ran out of my ear. It was as if I had started to cry out of the wrong hole. God knows I was crying enough out of the right ones by then. I raised my streaming face and looked unbelievingly at the ear doctor and the ear doctor's nurse. Then I looked at the cloth the nurse had spread over the top third of the exam table. It had a big wet patch on it. There were fine tendrils of yellow pus on it as well. "There," the ear doctor said, patting my shoulder. "You were very brave, Stevie, and it's all over." The next week, my mother called another taxi, and we went back to the ear doctor's, and I found myself once more lying on my side with the absorbent square of cloth under my head. The ear doctor once again produced the smell of alcohol, a smell I still associate, as I suppose many people do, with pain and sickness and terror, and with it, the long needle. He once more assured me that it wouldn't hurt, and I once more believed him. Not completely, but enough to be quiet while the needle slid into my ear. It did hurt. Almost as much as the first time, in fact. The smooching sound in my head was louder, too. This time it was giants kissing, sucking face and rotating tongues, as we used to say. "There," the ear doctor's nurse said when it was over and I lay there crying in a puddle of watery pus. "It only hurts a little. And you don't want to be deaf, do you? Besides, it's all over." I believed that for about 5 days, and then another taxi came. We went back to the ear doctor's. I remember the cab driver telling my mother that he was going to pull over and let us out if she couldn't shut that kid up. Once again, it was me on the exam table with the diaper under my head, and my mom out in the waiting room with a magazine she was probably incapable of reading, or so I like to imagine. Once again, the pungent smell of alcohol, and the doctor turning to me with a needle that looked as long as my school ruler. Once more the smile, the approach, the assurance that this time it wouldn't hurt. Since the repeated eardrum lancings when I was 6, one of my life's firmest principles has been this: fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me 3 times, shame on both of us. The 3rd time, on the ear doctor's table, I struggled and screamed and thrashed and fought. Each time the needle came near the side of my face, I knocked it away. Finally, the nurse called my mother in from the waiting room, and the 2 of them managed to hold me long enough for the doctor to get his needle in. I screamed so long and so loud that I can still hear it. In fact, I think that in some deep valley of my head, that last scream is still echoing. In a dull, cold month, not too long after that, it would have been January or February of 1954, if I've got the sequence right, the taxi came again. This time, the specialist wasn't the ear doctor, but a throat doctor. Once again, my mother sat in the waiting room. Once again, I sat on the examining table with a nurse hovering nearby. And once again, there was that sharp smell of alcohol, an aroma that still has the power to double my heartbeat in the space of 5 seconds. All that appeared this time, however, was some sort of throat swab. It stung, and it tasted awful, but after the ear doctor's long needle, it was a walk in the park. The throat doctor donned an interesting gadget that went around his head on a strap. It had a mirror in the middle and a bright, fierce light that shone out of it like a 3rd eye. He looked down my gullet for a long time, urging me to open wider until my jaws creaked, but he did not put needles into me, and so I loved him. After a while, he allowed me to close my mouth and summon my mother. The problem is his tonsils. the doctor said. They look like a cat clawed them. They'll have to come out. At some point after that, I remember being wheeled under bright lights. A man in a white mask bent over me. He was standing at the head of the table I was lying on. 1953 and 1954 were my years for lying on tables. And to me, he looked upside down. "Stephen," he said, "can you hear me?" I said I could. "I want you to breathe deep," he said. "When you wake up, you can have all the ice cream you want." He lowered a gadget over my face. In the eye of my memory, it looks like an outboard motor. I took a deep breath and everything went black. When I woke up, I was indeed allowed all the ice cream I wanted, which was a fine joke on me because I didn't want any. My throat felt swollen and fat. But it was better than the old needle-in-the-ear trick. Oh, yes. Anything would have been better than the old needle-in-the-ear trick. Take my tonsils if you have to. Put a steel birdcage on my leg if you must. But God save me from the otologist. That year, my brother David jumped ahead to the fourth grade, and I was pulled out of school entirely. I had missed too much of the first grade, my mother and the school agreed. I could start it fresh in the fall of the year if my health was good. Most of that year, I spent either in bed or housebound. I read my way through approximately 6 tons of comic books, progressed to Tom Swift and Dave Dawson, a heroic World War II pilot whose various planes were always prop-clawing for altitude. Then moved on to Jack London's blood-curdling animal tales. At some point, I began to write my own stories. Imitation preceded creation. I would copy Combat Casey comics word for word in my Blue Horse tablet, sometimes adding my own descriptions where they seemed appropriate. "They were camped in a big, dratty farmhouse room," I might write. It was another year or two before I discovered that draft and drat were different words. During that same period, I remember believing that details were dentals and that a bitch was an extremely tall woman. A son of a bitch was apt to be a basketball player. When you're 6, most of your bingo balls are still floating around in the draw tank. Eventually, I showed one of these copycat hybrids to my mother, and she was charmed. I remember her slightly amazed smile, as if she was unable to believe a kid of hers could be so smart, practically a damned prodigy, for God's sake. I had never seen that look on her face before, not on my account anyway, and I absolutely loved it. She asked me if I had made the story up myself, and I was forced to admit that I had copied most of it out of a funny book. She seemed disappointed, and that drained away much of my pleasure. At last, she handed back my tablet. "Write one of your own, Stevie," she said. "Those Combat Casey funny books are just junk. He's always knocking someone's teeth out. I bet you could do better. Write one of your own." I remember an immense feeling of possibility at the idea, as if I had been ushered into a vast building filled with closed doors and had been given leave to open any I liked. There were more doors than one person could ever open in a lifetime, I thought, and still think. I eventually wrote a story about 4 magic animals who rode around in an old car helping out little kids. Their leader was a large white bunny named Mr. Rabbit Trick. He got to drive the car. The story was 4 pages long, laboriously printed in pencil. No one in it, so far as I can remember, jumped from the roof of the Graymore Hotel. When I finished, I gave it to my mother, who sat down in the living room, put her pocketbook on the floor beside her, and read it all at once. I could tell she liked it. She laughed in all the right places. But I couldn't tell if that was because she liked me and wanted me to feel good or because it really was good. "You didn't copy this one?" she asked when she had finished. I said no, I hadn't. She said it was good enough to be in a book. Nothing anyone has said to me since has made me feel any happier. I wrote 4 more stories about Mr. Rabbit Trick and his friends. She gave me a quarter apiece for them and sent them around to her 4 sisters, who pitied her a little, I think. They were all still married, after all. Their men had stuck. It was true that Uncle Fred didn't have much sense of humor and was stubborn about keeping the top of his convertible up. It was also true that Uncle Oren drank quite a bit and had dark theories about how the Jews were running the world. But they were there. Ruth, on the other hand, had been left holding the baby when Don ran out. She wanted them to see that he was a talented baby, at least. Four stories, a quarter apiece. That was the first buck I ever made in this business. We moved to Stratford, Connecticut. By then, I was in the second grade and stone in love with the pretty teenage girl who lived next door. She never looked twice at me in the daytime, but at night, as I lay in bed and drifted towards sleep, we ran away from the cruel world of reality again and again. My new teacher was Mrs. Taylor, a kind lady with gray Elsa Lanchester Bride of Frankenstein hair and protruding eyes. When we're talking, I always want to cup my hands under Mrs. Taylor's peepers in case they fall out, my mom said. Our new third-floor apartment was on West Broad Street. A block down the hill, not far from Teddy's Market and across from Burritt's Building Materials, was a huge, tangled wilderness area with a junkyard on the far side and a train track running through the middle. This is one of the places I keep returning to in my imagination. It turns up in my books and stories again and again under a variety of names. The kids in IT called it the Barrens. We called it the jungle. Dave and I explored it for the first time not long after we had moved into our new place. It was summer. It was hot. It was great. We were deep into the green mysteries of this cool new playground when I was struck by an urgent need to move my bowels. Dave, I said, take me home. I have to push. This was the word we were given for this particular function. David didn't want to hear it. Go do it in the woods, he said. It would take at least half an hour to walk me home, and he had no intention of giving up such a shining stretch of time just because his little brother had to take a dump. I can't, I said, shocked by the idea. I won't be able to wipe. Sure you will, Dave said. Wipe yourself with some leaves. That's how the cowboys and Indians did it. By then, it was probably too late to get home anyway. I have an idea I was out of options. Besides, I was enchanted by the idea of shitting like a cowboy. I pretended I was Hopalong Cassidy, squatting in the underbrush with my gun drawn, not to be caught unawares even at such a personal moment. I did my business and took care of the cleanup as my older brother had suggested, carefully wiping my ass with big handfuls of shiny green leaves. These turned out to be poison ivy. 2 days later, I was bright red from the backs of my knees to my shoulder blades. My penis was spared, but my testicles turned into stoplights. My ass itched all the way up to my rib cage, it seemed. Yet worst of all was the hand I had wiped with. It swelled to the size of Mickey Mouse's after Donald Duck had bopped it with a hammer, and gigantic blisters formed at the places where the fingers rubbed together. When they burst, they left deep divots of raw, pink flesh. For 6 weeks, I sat in lukewarm starch baths, feeling miserable and humiliated and stupid, listening through the open door as my mother and brother laughed and listened to Peter Tripp's Countdown on the radio and played Crazy Eights. Dave was a great brother, but too smart for a 10-year-old. His brains were always getting him in trouble, and he learned at some point, probably after I had wiped my ass with poison ivy, that it was usually possible to get Brother Stevie to join him in the point position when trouble was in the wind. Dave never asked me to shoulder all the blame for his often brilliant fuck-ups. He was neither a sneak nor a coward, but on several occasions I was asked to share it, which was, I think, why we both got in trouble when Dave dammed up the stream running through the jungle and flooded much of Lower West Broad Street. Sharing the blame was also the reason we both ran the risk of getting killed while implementing his potentially lethal school science project. This was probably 1958. I was at Center Grammar School. Dave was at Stratford Junior High. Mom was working at the Stratford Laundry, where she was the only white lady on the mangle crew. That's what she was doing, feeding sheets into the mangle, while Dave constructed his science fair project. My big brother wasn't the sort of boy to content himself with drawing frog diagrams on construction paper or making the house of the future out of plastic Tyco bricks and painted toilet tissue rolls. Dave aimed for the stars. His project that year was Dave's super-duper electromagnet. My brother had great affection for things which were super-duper and things which began with his own name. This latter habit culminated with Dave's rag, which we will come to shortly. His first stab at the super-duper electromagnet wasn't very super-duper. In fact, it may not have worked at all. I don't remember for sure. It did come out of an actual book rather than Dave's head, however. The idea was this. You magnetized a spiked nail by rubbing it against a regular magnet. The magnetic charge imparted to the spike would be weak, the book said, but enough to pick up a few iron filings. After trying this, you were supposed to wrap a length of copper wire around the barrel of the spike and attach the ends of the wire to the terminals of a dry cell battery. According to the book, the electricity would strengthen the magnetism, and you could pick up a lot more iron filings. Dave didn't just want to pick up a stupid pile of metal flakes, though. Dave wanted to pick up Buicks, railroad boxcars, possibly army transport planes. Dave wanted to turn on the juice and move the world in its orbit. Pow! Super! We each had our part to play in creating the super-duper electromagnet. Dave's part was to build it. My part would be to test it. Little Stevie King, Stratford's answer to Chuck Yeager. Dave's new version of the experiment bypassed the pokey old dry cell, which was probably flat anyway when we bought it at the hardware store, he reasoned, in favor of actual wall current. Dave cut the electrical cord off an old lamp someone had put out on the curb with the trash, stripped the coating all the way down to the plug, then wrapped his magnetized spike in spirals of bare wire. Then, sitting on the floor in the kitchen of our West Broad Street apartment, he offered me the super-duper electromagnet and bade me do my part and plug it in. I hesitated. Give me at least that much credit. But in the end, Dave's manic enthusiasm was too much to withstand. I plugged it in. There was no noticeable magnetism, but the gadget did blow out every light and electrical appliance in our apartment, every light and electrical appliance in the building, and every light and electrical appliance in the building next door, where my dream girl lived in the ground floor apartment. Something popped in the electrical transformer out front, and some cops came. Dave and I spent a horrible hour watching from our mother's bedroom window, the only one that looked out on the street. All the others had a good view of the grassless, turd-studded yard behind us, where the only living thing was a mangy canine named Roop Roop. When the cops left, a power truck arrived. A man in spiked shoes climbed the pole between the two apartment houses to examine the transformer. Under other circumstances, this would have absorbed us completely, but not that day. That day, we could only wonder if our mother would come and see us in reform school. Eventually, the lights came back on and the power truck went away. We were not caught and lived to fight another day. Dave decided he might build a super-duper glider instead of a super-duper electromagnet for a science project. I, he told me, would get to take the first ride. Wouldn't that be great? I was born in 1947, and we didn't get our first television until 1958. The first thing I remember watching on it was Robot Monster, a film in which a guy dressed in an ape suit with a goldfish bowl on his head, Roman he was called, ran around trying to kill the last survivors of a nuclear war. I felt this was art of quite a high nature. I also watched Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford as the fearless Dan Matthews, and One Step Beyond, hosted by John Newland, the man with the world's spookiest eyes. There was Cheyenne and Sea Hunt, Your Hit Parade and Annie Oakley, There was Tommy Reddick as the first of Lassie's many friends, Jock Mahoney as the range rider, and Andy Devine yelling, "Hey, Wild Bill, wait for me," in his odd high voice. There was a whole world of vicarious adventure which came packaged in black and white, 14 inches across and sponsored by brand names, which still sound like poetry to me. I loved it all. But TV came relatively late to the King household, and I'm glad. I am, when you stop to think of it, a member of a fairly select group, the final handful of American novelists who learned to read and write before they learned to eat a daily helping of video bullshit. This might not be important. On the other hand, if you're just starting out as a writer, you could do worse than to strip your television's electrical plug wire, wrap a spike around it, and then stick it back into the wall. See what blows and how far. Just an idea. In the late 1950s, a literary agent and compulsive science fiction memorabilia collector named Forrest J. Ackerman changed the lives of thousands of kids. I was one. When he began editing a magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland. Ask anyone who has been associated with the fantasy, horror, science fiction genres in the last 30 years about this magazine and you'll get a laugh, a flash of the eyes, and a stream of bright memories. I practically guarantee it. Around 1960, Forey, who sometimes referred to himself as the Acker Monster, spun off the short-lived but interesting Spacemen, a magazine which covered science fiction films. In 1960, I sent a story to Spacemen. It was, as well as I can remember, the first story I ever submitted for publication. I don't recall the title, but I was still in the roman phase of my development, and this particular tale undoubtedly owed a great deal to the killer ape with the goldfish bowl on his head. My story was rejected, but Forey kept it. Forey keeps everything, which anyone who has ever toured his house, the Acker Mansion, will tell you. About 20 years later, while I was signing autographs at a Los Angeles bookstore, Forey turned up in line. With my story, single-spaced and typed with the long-vanished Royal typewriter my mom gave me for Christmas the year I was 11. He wanted me to sign it to him, and I guess I did, although the whole encounter was so surreal I can't be completely sure. Talk about your ghosts. Man, oh man. The first story I did actually publish was in a horror fanzine issued by Mike Garrett of Birmingham, Alabama. Mike is still around and still in the biz. He published this novella under the title In a Half World of Terror, but I still like my title much better. Mine was I Was a Teenage Grave Robber. Super duper. Pow.